south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 260, covering the week of May 3rd through May 7th, 2021. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, and subscribe to our YouTube page. You can find all those social media accounts at our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. While you're there, give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, Exploring the Southern Tradition. It's a great collection of essays, 20 essays by 20 Abbeville Institute scholars in defense of the Southern Tradition. Also, click on that support tab while you're there at abbevilleinstitute.org. You can throw a few pennies our way. You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time gift. We'll take anything as small as you can give to as large as you can give. We do exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you like this podcast, if you like our website, if you like our conferences, if you like our Zoom conferences, if you like all the things that we do, if you like our videos, consider a tax-deductible donation. We can't do those things without you. None of that stuff is free of charge. So we give most of it to you free of charge, but we do ask that you can help us financially. Also, click on that shop tab right at abbevilleinstitute.org. You can get your Abbeville Institute apparel. It's high-quality embroidered stuff. You can advertise the Institute while you're out in your golf shirt, your button-down shirt, your golf towel, lots of great things, hats, all kinds of cool stuff. So go on out there and click on that shop tab as well. And remember that the best way to get people to listen to our material is to share our material on social media. Rate this podcast where you get podcasts. Let people know you like the Institute and you like what we do. That's how we grow organically, and that is the best type of person to have. Not someone that's just a fly-by-night, but someone who really is dedicated to what we're doing. And that's how we're going to grow this thing, continue to grow this thing. It's been growing a lot. When we started this new website in 2014, it was April of 2014, so it's been 7 years now that we've started the process of reinventing our image. We're always doing the same thing, but our image, branding, and these other things, we've changed that a little bit over the years. It's been a great climb. We've gained a lot of new people, a lot of new supporters, made a lot of new friends. We love that kind of stuff. And we appreciate all of our old friends as well who've been with us since the beginning. The Institute was founded in 2002, but we really upgraded our online presence in 2014. And we're going to have some more of that coming up in the near future. Our website, as I've mentioned before, is getting an upgrade. It's going to have some cool stuff on it. And so we're really proud of that. And we have these new videos we've done. Now we're going to do more of those. We have these new webinars that we're doing. We're going to do more of that. So all of this stuff that we're trying to do, of course, our summer school. By the way, the summer school is sold out. There is no more space available at our conference center. That doesn't mean there's going to be an email going out if you're on our email list. That doesn't mean that you're not going to still have access to the summer school. We're going to offer something like a day pass. So, and we have a few seats for that. So if you want, if you're still interested in going, we will send out an email on how to do it. If you want to come to Charleston and you want to go to a few sessions at the summer school, not stay the night there, you may get off-site accommodations. There are some things you can do that with. So there still are some ways for you to get there and enjoy the summer school. These things are selling like hotcakes. When we have a conference, they sell out fast now. We only have so many seats, just like our Zoom webinars. We have 100 slots on those. They're usually gone within 24 hours. Not always. The last one, it took a few extra days to get it, but usually they're gone in 24 hours. So you need to jump on these things if you want to do them. By the way, the Abbeville Academy that we've set up, all those Zoom webinars, if you just go to abbevilleacademy.org, you can purchase any of those webinars that we've had. If you miss them, for $15, it's $5 more. That's kind of like a service charge for us to use the website that we're using and the time that it takes to put them there. But if you want to get those Zoom webinars, that's a great way to do it. And we've had a number. Started in December, so we've already had 5 of them over the last 5 months. It's been wonderful. I mean, we've had great discussions, a lot of discussions about different things. So we had one in December, one in January, one in February, one in March, and one in April. And we should have one coming up in May. Don't know the topic yet, what we're doing, but that's on the horizon. So it is only May 7th, May 8th. We're going to be doing another one probably near the end of the month. So just stay on the lookout for that. All right, let's talk about the week that we had. And we actually started this week and ended the week on the same note. And that is, how does the South fit into modern conservative thought? Does the South still have a place in that? Has it had a place in that since the late 19th century? I bring that up because, you know, when Russell Kirk wrote his book, The Conservative Mind, he talked about John C. Calhoun and John Randolph of Roanoke. In that period of time in the late 19th century, he called it conservatism frustrated. There weren't really any major conservative figures in the late 19th century. In fact, you could see it as the ascendancy of the left in so many ways. You did have conservatives. I mean, I would argue that Grover Cleveland was one. You had the National Democratic Party. You had people in that group that were conservatives. But Kirk is saying there aren't really any intellectual leaders at this particular time in conservatism. I would say that's sort of true and sort of not true. You had some pretty important thinkers in the South, but they'll be really paid much attention to them because they were Southerners first and foremost. And I think that's interesting about the South. Many Southerners just stopped participating in politics in the Reconstruction period and didn't really get as involved in it as they had before the war. You know, in 1860, the voter turnout in 1860 was 80% across the United States. Very high. And so, but after the war is over, you start seeing that go down and down. Now, you've added to the electorate. Once you get to the 1870 and you have the 15th Amendment, now, regardless of race, you can vote in the United States. We know that there were some hiccups with that, and that's a nice way of putting it, with some restrictions in states that we look back at this now and say, well, that, you know, that was wrong for people to do that. But on the other hand, we know that by that can shrink the percentages, you know, if you don't have these many people, so that shrinks. But we know a lot of white Southerners, too, refused to participate in politics when the war was over for a period of time after, particularly during Reconstruction, if they could at all. The 14th Amendment, of course, disfranchised a large number of white Southerners. But they slowly got back into it by the late 19th, early 20th century. It's interesting, though, that this period of time is often seen as this very strange, apolitical period, and that there weren't really any conservative voices. Well, Boyd Cathy talks about it Monday. I mean, this idea on Monday. The South has had a something conservative to offer American politics for a long period of time. You know, R.L. Dabney, he spent a lot of time researching and studying R.L. Dabney. And Dabney had a lot of wonderful things to say about American society in the post-war period and where it was going and where he thought there were going to be some problems. And you look at what he said about things, you know, when it came to reform movements. And he said, look, this is conservatism essentially is just adopting the leftover reformist ideas from 20 years ago. And think about what that is today. Think about the conservative movement today and what it advocates. It's even if you look at their love affair, Conservative Inc.'s love affair with Abraham Lincoln, for example. Lincoln was by no means called a conservative in 1860. Now, the radicals called him a conservative, but nobody else looked at him that way. Nobody else viewed Abraham Lincoln as a conservative. Southerners certainly didn't. Northern Democrats certainly didn't. Lincoln was a conservative. He was someone who was a reformer on the left. But yet now he's a conservative. The neoconservatives think Lincoln is a conservative. This is how they sell him. He's a conservative. Frederick Douglass now is a champion of the Conservative Inc., the neoconservative right. Frederick Douglass wasn't a conservative. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, same thing, conservative. These people weren't conservatives. They weren't conservatives in their times. And now, of course, at the Abbeville Institute, we've called Jefferson a conservative. And I have people that I know who are Jefferson scholars who say there's no way Jefferson was a conservative. That's distorting who Jefferson was. It depends on how you define that conservatism. Was he conservative in Virginia? Absolutely not. Jefferson was a reformer within his own state. But it stopped there. Jefferson really didn't want to reform New England. He just didn't really care about New England. And his commitment to federalism was his underlying principle his entire political career. Commitment to federalism, which really is, when I say federalism, the Federal Republic. That really is the core essence of American conservatism. You have to be committed to a federal republic. And that means that you may not get the people of California, if you don't live there, to vote your way on certain issues. It means that Massachusetts might be Massachusetts. But it also means that your state, whether it's South Carolina or Alabama or Montana, can be your state It doesn't have to be theirs. It's yours. The states reflect the political culture. These states, with millions of people in them, reflect the political culture of the people of those states. And we've seen how this worked in the current situation with the restrictions or non-restrictions during this last year. We've seen some states in the South in particular lift these lockdown restrictions, and they've been happier places than other parts of the United States where people have been suffering under some of the lockdowns and other things. So this is interesting. That's the commitment to federalism. And the South offered that for a long period of time. But you see, the neoconservatives, because that then was used at one point to defend segregation, it was used to defend slavery, whatever it is, you know, this idea of states' rights used for these things, this is how they say it. Well, then that whole tradition is no good. We just got to adopt the Lincolnian nationalism, which is false. It's false. And I point this out in the last piece of the week is by yours truly on Richard Weaver, the great Southern philosopher. In 1960, he wrote an essay talking about where the conservatives and libertarians had a lot of common ground. And that one thing for him was John C. Calhoun. It was the glue that held those two groups together. And that's because Calhoun, in his mind, viewed the Constitution as a series of no's. The Constitution was a restriction on unlimited federal power. And so when you look at conservatives, and he called conservatives as defenders of liberty, you look at libertarians as defenders of liberty, this is the one thing they had in common. They had a reverence for this Constitution as a series of no's. And that's important. Because if we look at the Constitution in any other way, and the Southern tradition never really did, then we have the Lincolnian interpretation of the Union, the Hamiltonian interpretation of the Union, the John Marshall interpretation of the Union. Now, John Marshall was a Southerner. There's no doubt about it. John Marshall, and this is what's so interesting about Virginia. John Marshall, the nationalist, the loose constructionist, was opposed by men in Richmond, the Richmond Junto, also John Taylor of Caroline, St. George Tucker, Abel Upshur. I mean, all of these people from Virginia opposed the Virginian, either during his lifetime or after. And so that's a really interesting part of this entire tradition and why I find it so much fun to read about this period. But Richard Weaver certainly thought that the common bond between these groups in 1960 when he wrote this was, of course, a commitment to the Constitution is no. But the other thing he said in that essay, I think is good, and Boyd brings this up too, is how the left hasn't really changed much in what they're trying to do. Richard Weaver talks about this. He said, look, the left doesn't really care about free speech. The left doesn't care about free exchange of ideas. The left doesn't want those things. They don't want those things because if they're there, they lose. If people are allowed to choose for themselves which ideas to listen to, the left's ideas aren't usually as attractive, at least in Weaver's mind. Now, if it's giving away stuff, well, then the left gets away like gangbusters because people just want free money. They want free goods. They want free services. They want free money. They don't see it as there's a penalty for this. I mean, I'll never forget, you know, I've had colleagues say, well, it's a grant. It's free. It's free money. Well, it comes from somewhere. If it's a federal grant, it comes from taxpayer dollars, or at least printing the money. It's not really free. It's just you get money they print. And is it even constitutional to do it? I mean, these are questions that you have. But certainly, we've got this idea that as the left has an idea that they want to stifle dissent, they want to stifle free speech. You see it all the time. This is cancel culture. Richard Weaver was talking about cancel culture in 1960. 1960, he's talking about it. Amazing when you think about it. Amazing. Of course, Dabney was talking about the modern conservative movement in the late 19th century. Yeah, conservatives just adopt whatever the leftover leftist position is, and they say that's now conservative. They don't actually conserve anything. And that's because the Republican Party was actually born out of radicalism. And it hasn't changed. It never will change. That is the lost part of all of that. So we have these two pieces that really bookend and ask the question, why is Southern conservatism not necessarily recognized in modern mainstream society? Why can't people separate these things. And on my own podcast over at brianmcclanahan.com, I talked about a piece by a man named Elmers, where he talks about this unity. Is unity even worth it anymore? And he actually brings up Harry Jaffa, who's kind of the intellectual king of neoconservatism and Lincoln worship in America on the conservative side. And even Jaffa started trying to split hairs because he understood, well, if I'm a Lincoln guy, I can't really say I like secession and nullification. But you know what? Jefferson and Madison weren't really pushing nullification for slavery or racism in 1798. It was for civil liberty. So maybe we should actually like nullification. But it has to be for the right thing. It can't be for the wrong thing. Well, I mean, anybody now would realistically look at that and say, okay, well, yeah, I mean, it has to be for the right thing. It can't be for the wrong thing. And the other thing about nullification that people don't get, they say, well, if you believe in nullification, you're just going to nullify any law you don't like. No, that's not how it works. You nullify unconstitutional laws. Constitutional laws, even if you don't like it, you got to follow those laws. Just because the Congress passes it, the president signs it, and even if the Supreme Court says it's constitutional, doesn't mean it really is. That's the great mystery of all of this stuff. So where we are with these pieces, I think that they're both very good questions. We need more Richard Weaver in our lives. We need more R.L. Dabney and his prognostications. We need more of the Southern conservative tradition and all of its benefits. Does it have burdens that it has? Well, certainly. You don't emulate those things, but all of its benefits would be good for modern American society. Now, the other pieces of the week, we had some really good stuff, as we normally do. We have the third part of Earl Starbuck's series on Robert E. Lee entitled Robert E. Lee, the Soldier. Now, the idea of the first two pieces, Lee the Believer and Lee the Father. I mean, this personal side of Lee's life is just so interesting. He really was a great man in terms of just a good human being. And that's what the left really tries to tear down more than anything else. That's what they're trying to tear down more than anything else. Lee as a good man. Because if he wasn't a good man, if you read the Atlantic piece on Lee and the myth of the kindly General Lee and these kind of things, that's the whole point. Because if Lee really was a good man, then why would you tear down his statue? Why? But then you have to ask the question, why would Booker T. Washington want monuments to these men that he called the best of Southern society? Why would he want that? Why? Well, because, of course, he recognized these people as good men. Every man has faults, but you have to weigh those things out. And I think what Starbuck is doing here is saying, look, the positive side of Lee the man, Lee the father, Lee the soldier, that far outweighs anything else the left can throw at him. He's addressing this to Christians who have abandoned Robert E. Lee. And that's why the first piece was on Lee the Believer. He's addressing that audience. But he brings up in the second paragraph some quotes from well-respected people on Lee. Early in 1861, U.S. General-in-Chief and Hero of the Mexican War, Winfield Scott described Lee as the very best soldier that I ever saw in the field. Ulysses S. Grant, Lee's most successful opponent, described him as sad and depressed when Lee surrendered and said he could not rejoice at the downfall of a foe who had fought so long and so valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause. Teddy Roosevelt clearly admired Lee. Woodrow Wilson praised the general. So did Franklin Delano Roosevelt. During his time as President of the United States, World War II hero Dwight Eisenhower took time out of his day to write a private letter defending Lee from a critic. Winston Churchill is supposed to have remarked, Lee was the noblest American who ever lived and one of the greatest commanders known to the annals of war. Despite being such an excellent soldier, Lee did not welcome the breakup of the Union or the war, both of which he prayed God would prevent. In later life, he denounced Bismarck's invasion of France. Think about that. Denounce Bismarck's invasion of France. Now, this is the Franco-Prussian War. And why was Bismarck doing that? Well, because he was trying to unify Germany. It was part of it. That was the blood and iron Bismarck talked about. So I like this piece by Starbuck because it gets into these kind of things, right? It talks about Lee as the great man, the great symbol of the South. And this is everything the left tries to tear down. That is their main goal. Again, because if Lee is nothing but a middle-class man, an average middle-class man who was a bad general with some type of weird fetishes and other things, as Elizabeth Pryor tries to say, then he doesn't deserve these statues that are put up in his honor. He doesn't deserve any of that. And what they would say is, well, if all these people knew the real Lee, then Lee would not be as revered as he is today. If these people just knew the real Robert E. Lee. Well, I think we've had the real Robert E. Lee in front of us for decades. This is Douglas Southall Freeman's book, his four-volume account of Lee. The real Lee has been there for decades. Most people don't read it. They say, oh, Douglas Southall Freeman. Well, he just believes Robert E. Lee is Jesus walking on earth. He saluted General Lee every day. Well, maybe there's a reason that Freeman wrote that volume, and it's so laudatory of the man. He also wrote a great multi-volume biography of George Washington. Nobody despises him for that. Nobody says, well, it's just too laudatory. Because you can admire Washington. You can admire that man. I mean, nobody goes out and says, well, John Marshall admired Washington too much, so we can't listen to John Marshall. He admired this guy too much. But because Douglas Southall Freeman wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning biography, well, and he had the ear of President Eisenhower, and he was an important newspaperman, an important journalist. People listened to Douglas Southall Freeman on the radio every day. Well, that's just creating the myth of the Lee myth, the lost cause myth. It's also maybe Freeman was reading the sources accurately. Maybe Freeman was actually looking at things and saying, you know, there's a lot to this. And certainly, I think Freeman tried to always give Lee the benefit of the doubt. That is a problem as you write biographies and you start to become interested in them. And of course, those people speak to you and then you say, well, I mean, I really do kind of, maybe what they're saying here is true. It's very hard to be objective when you start doing that. But I think that overall, we've always had the real Lee in front of us. We've always had the real Lee in front of us. And I think Earl Starbuck has done a wonderful job in bringing that out. And so we've got one more installment in this series. It'll be out next week. And, I mean, it's great that we have these. I do, you know, thank him tremendously for writing, taking the time. These are extensive essays. These aren't just well footnoted. I mean, they're very well footnoted. They're not just some kind of, you know, throw it up there and let's go with it. And then we had a nice piece on Southern religion. It's by Karen Stokes. It's a book entitled Preachers with Power, Four Stalwarts of the South, written by Douglas Kelly. And, of course, Ms. Stokes has written a lot for the Institute. And she said she was interested in this book because Kelly is a minister. And one of the things he does that's interesting is that he actually takes seriously some Southern theologians that most of modern Christian society doesn't even want anything to do with anymore. And what I mean by that is that people like James Henley Thornwell, who, because of his defense of slavery, is often just, oh, we can't. I mean, he has been removed from, his name has essentially been removed from Columbia, South Carolina, and the church that he was part of, because he was a pro-slavery ideologue, at least in terms of religion. And what Kelly says is, look, I mean, we don't agree with him on that, but he had a lot of other interesting things to say and a lot of other things that were worthwhile. So why can't we listen to those things and just say, you know, he's wrong on these other issues? Why can't we do that in modern American society? This is the question. Well, we can't do it because most Americans aren't intellectual. These are emotional responses to things. You know, well, that person didn't have racial views that I find appealing, so I can't listen to anything they had to say. This is just a stupid argument in reality. We don't do that with some people. We don't do that. We don't do it with Lincoln. Lincoln said some pretty horrible things about black Americans and from our modern perspective. He said some pretty awful things, but we don't go out and say, well, Lincoln said these things. We can't like Lincoln because of that. Usually it's so what, but he said all kinds of other things that were important. We can do it with some people, but not others. And I think that's the real problem. Southerners are never really given a pass in this way. It's because they figured they favored these things we find abhorrent today. But you know what? That's all there is to them. There's nothing else. They never said anything else good or worthwhile or valuable. That's why the whole institute exists. What is true and valuable in the Southern tradition? Are these things true and valuable? No. Are these things valuable? Yes. So why can't we emulate those things? That's the real question. And the end result of all of this, as Casey Chalk points out, is wokeism. He calls it, he says, wokeism is like kudzu. And I love, kudzu is an invasive species that has taken over the South. You drive down the road and you see all these vines overgrowing everything. Like you can't even see stuff that was left there. It's horrible stuff. And you can't get rid of it very easily. And that's what wokeism is. It's a kudzu. And he's warning Southerners and states outside of Virginia. He's writing as a Virginian. He's saying, look. Now, I'll say this. Chalk is, he's not someone who is, pro-Southern. He's conservative. He's from Virginia, but he said, all my family were Union veterans, and I never really thought much about the South. But as these attacks on these statues started happening, I started thinking, well, wait a second here. It's not just going to be Confederates. You see, like a lot of people, Confederates, I don't know. But as they started attacking, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, George Mason, or people like John Singleton Mosby, who was also, he brings us up in the piece. Mosby was dedicated to the federal government after the war, but we're going to take him down because he wasn't woke enough, because he had this failing in his life in the eyes of the woke mob. He says, when these name changes first began, I was skeptical and suspicious. They claimed to be targeting only so-called Confederate traitors. But it was immediately obvious the activists had a far broader ideological agenda in mind. This was ultimately an attempt to tar our shared American history as something so deeply evil that any honoring of it must be dismantled and destroyed. The vilification of Jefferson, Mason, and even Mosby proved my suspicions accurate. This is a campaign to fundamentally remake America and its understanding of itself. He says, men and women are complicated. Even our greatest heroes had flaws and made mistakes. Their failures, like those of Jefferson or Mason, may obscure their achievements, but they cannot eradicate them. All of us, whether we live in the Old Dominion or not, are indebted to such men for helping to create this wonderful nation. That Northern Virginians would so carelessly dispense with such heroes exposes both their ignorance and their hypocrisy. The former, in that the very ideas they espouse, liberty, equality, and human dignity, were made possible by the men they now cancel. The latter, in the same that these same Northern Virginian elites, through their pro-choice policies, affect the murdering of the unborn, an evil even greater than the enslaving of our fellow man. No statue or memorial should ever honor these people because they themselves have shown such contempt for their patrimony. He says, I warn my fellow Southerners who inhabit the deeper districts of Dixie, beware of what is happening in Northern Virginia, the same region that gave our nation Washington, Mason, and Lee, among other noblemen. This woke progressivism, like the invasive species kudzu, is going to keep spreading across the South unless men of goodwill rise up to resist it. If they don't, the South, covered in this anti-human, anti-historical hogwash, like Southern trees covered in foot of night vine, will no longer be recognizable. And I agree. I mean, this is what we've been saying since 2015. I remember the Christian Science Monitor, again, I've said this before, called me. They interviewed Marshall DeRosa, too, and they said, hey, what do you think about it? I said, look, it's not going to stop. I mean, you can take down Lee today. It's going to be Jefferson, Washington tomorrow. When President Trump said this, Donald Trump said this as president, I mean, oh, no, that's not going to happen. But, of course, he was right. He said, well, do you like Washington? He was a slave owner. But they found our country. They weren't traitors. Well, but people are going to come after them because the reason they're coming after these people supposedly is because they're racist slave owners, not because they did anything. So the qualification has to be then, well, we can keep these slave owners around because, they were good. They didn't destroy the country. But these slave owners destroyed the country. But now, that's what the neoconservative side usually picks. But now, once the left goes after them, well, then where do you stand? This is the real problem with all of it. So I love all the stuff this week. We had a lot of great material. I love doing these podcasts once a week, and I appreciate every one of you that tune in for them. Share this stuff around. Let people know you're listening. We've had a steadily growing audience. It would be great if we had more. And it would be great if more people listen to this podcast, because I think this is, you know, a key to getting communication and the information out there with people and letting them see there's another side to this. There's another side of the story. That's what real robust intellectual debate is about. It's about a conversation. You can believe me or not. You can believe the other side or not. That's your choice. Hopefully you believe our side. But if you don't, okay. That was the real spirit of the idea of, you know, having free speech and free press, to have both sides, to have that liberty to have those things. And that's clearly, we were warned about it in 1960. It's clearly what we're facing today. Until next time, good day.